Show on UK Health Radio. Regular listeners will know that I'm Robin Daly, the chairman and founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, helping people with cancer to learn about the benefits of integrative medicine. Another UK charity we work alongside does some brilliant work that's beyond our remit, but we completely support. Breast Cancer UK focuses on prevention of breast cancer, investigating the many potential drivers of cancer, educating the public on strategies to avoid a diagnosis, and campaigning for regulatory changes to protect public health. I'm delighted to have this opportunity during Breast Cancer Awareness Month to speak to Tali Martini, the CEO of Breast Cancer UK, about the enormously important work they do. Hi Tali, a big welcome to the Yes Live Show.
Thank you, a pleasure to be with you.
So I've long admired the stance of BCUK, which I'm guessing must have been the very first charity in the UK to focus exclusively on prevention. Is that right, first of all, and when was it founded, and what was the initial thinking behind it?
Well, actually, we aren't and we weren't the original breast cancer prevention charity. But what makes us unique and what has done since we were founded in 2001, so 20 odd years ago, this year's our 20th anniversary, is that we actually started out as a campaigning organisation on environmental risk factors for breast cancer. Yeah. So we looked at issues around toxic and endocrine disrupting chemicals. So that was our raison d'etre when we first started out. But today we've actually broadened our remit to include all risk factors for breast cancer. So we look at the environmental risk factors I just mentioned, but we also look at all the lifestyle factors. And there are other prevention charities, but we're unique in that we cover all of those risk factors.
Yeah, great. Well, very good to know that somebody's doing this stuff. So if you look at this rationally, if the numbers being diagnosed with cancer are increasing rapidly all the time, which they are, then focusing attention almost exclusively on treatment, which is what's going on, makes about as much sense as getting more and more buckets to catch roof leaks rather than actually going up there and fixing the roof. So I wonder, why do you think so little attention goes into prevention?
Well, it's quite a complex question there. The first thing I want to state is that we do really agree with the treatment service and the investment that's gone into treatment, because there's been so much progress and we're very grateful for all that. And cases have risen quite sharply, particularly in the past 50 years. They've doubled. So every year around 56,000 women are diagnosed with breast cancer. It's difficult to say how the rates are going now. We don't think that they're continuing to spiral upwards. In fact, we think they're probably plateauing, but it's complicated with COVID. The issue around prevention is that the evidence is sound and it's understood. But I think one of the issues that prevents, I suppose, further funding and further attention going into it is the fact that it's difficult to quantify impact. So it requires a long-term investment. It requires a clear understanding of what we're investing in, and that can take a very long time. So, for example, our efforts can take years and years to translate into reduced cases, for example. And I think it's difficult to convince particularly policymakers that that long-term investment is required, but it's equally difficult to translate that to supporters. And it's, you know, it's probably less attractive than a breakthrough in cancer treatment that will attract, you know, more attention and probably more funding. So what we believe is that prevention is neglected, and that's why we've heavily focused not only on investing in research and investing in education, but also in raising awareness about the importance of prevention. Now, not all breast cancers can be prevented, so that's true. So, you know, but there's an awful lot that can, over 25% of cases. And that's why we believe it's really, really important to stop neglecting this area, particularly in research, so we can better understand what the causes are and how we can prevent it.
Absolutely. Yeah, it makes complete sense. It feels like the kind of going back to basics that is happening with a lot of the environmental stuff, in as much as people are realising that what's been going on for the last 50 years, we're going to pay a very heavy price for it if we don't carry on the same way. And we literally need to go back and look at how we're doing things in a very basic way. And this, of course, this issue, from the point of view of the environment, is completely linked up with our own health. So, you know, you're on the same mission, really, in a way. Well, fantastic. So the headline fact you're trying to promote is just how many of this vast and ever-increasing number of diagnoses are actually preventable. So you mentioned a figure there of at yeah. least 25%. It may be a lot higher. Some people would say it was. Mm. So how do you come about your figures? Do you do your own research?
Yes. So what we do is we fund lab research and we also fund university research, but we don't carry out the research ourselves. What we do internally is that we develop scientific briefing papers. So we use the data that we learn from our own commissioned research, but we also look way beyond that at scientific journals, and we're also informed by national and international statistics. And we use all of these. We spend a lot of time collecting this data, making sure we're up to date on all the data. So, you know, things from internationally, WHO, locally in England, the ONS figures, the Cancer Research UK figures. And there's an awful lot of places we go to collect our data. And if we look across those data sets, you're right in terms of the preventable case of breast cancer. You know, we've been quite conservative when we talk about over 25% because, you know, there's a lot of studies that indicate that it is higher than that. It can be even up to 30 or 40% of cases could be prevented. And most of these could be prevented through lifestyle factors and lifestyle habits that we individually can change, but there's also public health policies that could help us to, you know, really change those too. So, yeah, 56,000 cases every year, I mentioned earlier on, of breast cancers that are diagnosed. So if we look at just 25% of those, that's 13,000 cases that could be prevented. Enormous. And for us, that's just too high.
Yeah.
And that's why, you know, we're really focused on preventing those, because that's a lot of lives, it's a lot of suffering that could be prevented through education. A lot of people we talk to don't even know that breast cancer can be prevented, but, you know, there are some breast cancers that can be prevented. So that's the very first step. And then there's understanding what we can do to prevent it.
Mm. Yeah, it's a complex topic. Yeah, so, yeah, you mentioned two sides there. There's the kind of the personal choices we're making, and then there's the public health aspects, which is kind of what's happening in the environment generally. And you know, you can feel that we're a bit disempowered in relation to those, but there nonetheless are actually quite a few things we can do to avoid the things that are happening in the public environment or to minimise the impact of them. And is that the sort of thing you look into as well?
Yes. Yeah, so we divide up our time between educating the public, but also working with government and working with public health organisations to put policies in place. So starting with our education, and we've done a lot of work recently on our education. We've developed a new prevention hub. We only released it in June as part of our 20th anniversary. And what we do there is we provide individuals with the opportunity to go in, enter a quiz, answer a few questions about their lifestyle, answer a few questions about their family background, because some breast cancers are linked to family history, and also, you know, their own personal circumstances. Once they've completed the quiz, then they can develop their own personal prevention plan. So it means actions that people can take on their individual basis to start to reduce their risk. And the key message we say is that it's never too soon. So even though breast cancer is a disease that becomes more prevalent with age, it's never too soon to start prevention. And the kind of things that we talk to people about are, you know, quite standard. They won't be new to It won't be news to people. Things like maintaining a healthy weight, particularly when women are postmenopause, that's a very high risk factor for women postmenopause. The other areas that we talk to people about are alcohol. Alcohol is a very well-established risk factor for breast cancer development. And what we say is keep your alcohol intake to a minimum, or the safest bet is actually to have no alcohol, because there's no lower limit to safe alcohol. A really great protective thing that we can do is to stay physically active. So to introduce regular physical activity in our everyday lives, and it doesn't mean running marathons. It doesn't mean, it actually means sticking to the guidelines, the 150 to 300 minutes of moderate activity. But that moderate activity can be done in so many different ways. And that's what we try to encourage. We try to provide, you know, tips for how, you know, maybe get off the bus earlier, take the stairs rather than the lift. There are so many alternatives to some of the choices we make that can make huge changes to both our general health, but also our breast cancer risk. And then, of course, our diet is very important as well. And we do always talk about diet, but it is incredibly important to have the right balance of fruit and vegetables, high fiber diet, and minimize things like sugar, you know, and fat. And the reason for that is that a healthy diet and also activity, you know, physical activity helps reduce circulating hormones in our body, hormones such as estrogen, and estrogen, or high rates of estrogen circulating in our body, is what can increase our risk of developing breast cancer.
Right. Right. Yeah, that exercise factor is realised in recent years is a massive part of this whole, you know, our sedentary lifestyle is contributing much more than anybody might have ever guessed. And a small amount of activity makes an enormous difference to the stats, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And so we've seen some studies that show that regular physical activity can reduce breast cancer risk by 20%. But not only does it reduce our risk of ever developing the disease, it also reduces our risk of recurrence if we've had a diagnosis. And it dramatically decreases mortality rates as well for people who've had a diagnosis by about 40%. So what you're seeing is physical activity alone is like a pill in some respects that, you know, is really, really effective. Yeah. And that alongside other lifestyle changes can really have an impact.
Yeah, they all add up. Okay, yeah. So it would seem to me, Tali, that, you know, if you look at a world map of the incidence of cancer, it's kind of obvious that cancer follows the money. Broadly speaking, the richer a country is, the more cancer it's got, which tells me that it's got something to do with the lifestyle that we're adopting as developed nations. So I think you're on board with that. You've already been talking about the lifestyle changes that have been happening in recent decades. What do you think the key mistakes are that we're making that are damaging our health so radically?
Yeah, and you're right. The cases of breast cancer are much higher in wealthier regions, so Australasia, Western Europe, North America. They're about four times higher than the poorer regions. And so it certainly does look like our lifestyle in the wealthier regions is having an impact on our breast cancer risk. The one exception in the wealthier region is Japan, where the incidence rates aren't higher. And we think that might be related to diet and potentially other protective factors such as more physical activity. There are things in our modern world. So I've talked about, you know, sedentary behaviour. I've talked about, you know, our diet and our alcohol intake. They all contribute to that increased risk. And you know, in the wealthier regions, they do seem to be risks that are more common. But there are certain protective factors that we see happening probably more in some of the poorer regions. And they relate to things like breastfeeding, for example, mothers having children younger, and those actually are protective risk factors. So if a woman is planning on having children, having them younger will reduce her risk, as well as breastfeeding, and those are well-established protective factors, and they tend to be a point of difference between some of the poorer regions and the wealthier regions. So there's lots of factors that we can see happening in wealthy regions that would contribute towards this increased amount of cases, particularly what we've seen in the past 50 years.
Very interesting. So that, like, if you take something like the age at which women get pregnant, that's something which is definitely going in the other direction here, isn't it? It's becoming later and later. And you can imagine how, yes, in a poorer country, there isn't even the luxury of thinking about later and later. It doesn't happen. But but it's interesting. It is, as you say, it's a lifestyle choice.
But it seems to be not working for us in that way. The message with breastfeeding seems to have hit home, though, in recent times. I mean, you know, when I was younger, and nobody wanted to breastfeed, it seemed. But it's actually, people have realised that it is actually the best thing to do all round from every point of view, including this one. And so it's kind of the done thing now. That's my take on it.
Yeah, I think so. I don't really know what the figures are, what the breastfeeding figures are. I don't think they're great for the UK. Oh, no. I think the UK has one of the lowest rates of breastfeeding. But one thing we definitely have is a huge body of evidence around breastfeeding. And that's one thing we're developing right now, actually. I mentioned earlier on about the fact that we do our own kind of desk research. And so we're pulling together all of the research journals around this very issue. And there is a huge amount of evidence associated, and it's well understood as well in the medical professions that breastfeeding is a protective factor. But in the UK, I'm not so sure the figures are as high as they could be. And there's lots of reasons for that, you know. So it's a really difficult, complex subject because lifestyle choices are really important. And so when we talk about risk and protective factors, it's actually the combination of all of those. It's not just one thing in particular that we're encouraging people to do. We're encouraging people to look at their whole life and think, well, what are some things that I can change? Breastfeeding's not for everyone and not everyone's going to have children, but it doesn't mean there aren't other protective factors and other risk factors that they can change to reduce their risk for breast cancer.
Right, so it's something we need to be aware of, this is the thing, because if you get going into it blindly, you are opening yourself to risk unnecessarily. Yeah, so one thing is a bit of an anomaly you brought up there about Japan. Very interesting. If you think about the side of it, which is the lifestyle side, if you like, which is to do with the materials we live around, the materials and the environment, Japan presumably is not so different to anywhere else in the developed world. And yet there is this element of the toxic environment that plays into it. I just wonder how much you think of the overall burden of disease here is you can attribute to the environment and the materials we live with.
Yes, so that's one of the questions we are looking into. And in fact, we fund our research exclusively into this area because we think it's little understood. Mm. How much does it contribute generally to disease? We think quite significantly because there's a whole, when we talk about chemicals, we talk about endocrine disrupting chemicals, yeah, and other toxic chemicals and carcinogens. But in particular for breast cancer or hormone related cancers, we are concerned about EDCs and the impact they have on, in the case of breast cancer, kind of mimicking estrogen or being estrogenic. How much do they contribute to breast cancer? That's a difficult question to answer because there's not been enough research done into it. More research needs to be done. But there's been sufficient research done for us to be concerned enough to recommend precaution or the precautionary principle. And in fact, that's something that's been applied at EU level, and there's been quite a lot of progress at EU level around how we manage EDCs in our everyday life, particularly from a public health perspective, less so here. But what we say at Breast Cancer UK is that where we interact with, say, products or the environment where there are known EDCs or suspected EDCs, the best course of action in the absence of very concrete evidence about the link is the precautionary approach. Because, you know, there's been lots of instances in the past where there's been concern over certain, so for example, if we were to use cigarettes, for example, and tobacco, there was concern raised a long, long time ago before the evidence came to the fore. And even to this day, you know, we suspect that smoking contributes to breast cancer, but there's not been enough evidence actually to link it. But nevertheless, we know it's a carcinogen, so we would always urge caution. And the same could be said for endocrine disrupting chemicals. And so part of the advice we provide the public is to avoid these chemicals as much as possible. And we give that information in our hub. If people go to our hub, we have a whole eye guide on chemicals in the environment and where we might find them and how we can avoid them. And then we also urge government to do a lot more to not only link the concerns we have from a public health perspective, because at the moment, all the responsibilities around environmental chemicals are dealt with more on an environmental level rather than a public health level.
Right.
But we're also urging government to really look at these chemicals and restrict them with a view to protecting public health.
Excellent. So interesting, you talked about this precautionary principle, and you're absolutely right that it doesn't get, as far as I can tell, it's never got used at all. What happens is that it's realised that something is probably killing people, but then there's a 50-year gap between that point and the point of which it's proven beyond doubt that it's killing people. You know, if you take asbestos, for example, it was known in the 1920s that it killed people. And yet, by the time they banned it, everywhere, every school, every hospital, you know, the whole planet was filled with asbestos, we now have to pay through the nose to have it removed carefully and all the rest of it, and you can't touch it. You know, it's ridiculous that the cautionary principle is not applied ever, and it's only this sort of concrete, bulletproof case that it definitely kills that actually gets the law changed. I mean, do you think there's any openness to bringing in a precautionary principle in government?
Well, the precautionary principle, funnily enough, the government did subscribe to as part of our arrangement with the European Union. Right. And it's in leaving the European Union that actually that precautionary principle in theory is in place, but we are at risk now because we're diverging away from some of that legislation. We are at risk of kind of letting go of that precautionary principle. But there's still more work to do. I mean, the EU hasn't got it all right.
No.
One thing I want to point out is that with EDCs, they're everywhere. You know, the science around EDCs has been around for long enough. They were coined in the 1990s, but actually we first noticed EDCs in the 70s in kind of polluted rivers. We would see wildlife that was affected. One of the things that was found here in the UK was that fish in the 1980s were found to have male and female characteristics, so testes and ovaries. And so when that was found, they found that it was related to some of the sewage waste and that it was high in synthetic estrogens, which is EDCs. Now we find it everywhere, the Antarctic, animals in the Antarctic, animals in the Arctic, in our own flesh, in our blood. It's everywhere. So when we talk about the precautionary principle, we're saying, well, actually, we know now that EDCs are everywhere. We suspect that they're contributing to all sorts of diseases, including hormonal cancers such as breast cancer. Now we need to look very carefully and say, well, the only approach to this is to approach it as a public health crisis. And that precautionary principle is to say, well, where we know that there's these EDCs in everyday products, one example is BPA. And you probably have heard of the fact that quite recently, actually, BPA was restricted in most products, which is great because it's a known EDC and there's a lot of evidence to suggest that it does have links to hormonal cancers. However, it's not entirely restricted, and here it's still found in food contact materials, so that can leach into our food. And there are other bisphenols that are being used now as substitutes, but we are concerned that they're demonstrating very similar qualities to the BPA and therefore could be estrogenic as well. So we are funding research around this very topic because we need to underline the evidence to match our concerns. And that's where it's so important that we get, you know, more support to get this research done. But until we've got this evidence, the precautionary principle, as you say, is ever so important.
Yeah, I only recently heard that the kind of loads of the things that have BPA-free written on them, they just substituted it for something else which could be just as bad. And, of course, and then you have to make a case against that thing. And, you know, it just goes on and on. It's endless, isn't it? It's a bit like crime and police, and they're not really keeping up with the development of the crimes. They're developing cleverer and cleverer ways of doing it at a faster rate than you're actually managing to stop them. So, we need a much bigger principle than having to pick off each one at a time. It's like they should be making a case for a new chemical. They should have to prove beyond doubt that it's safe rather than the other way around. You know, it's the wrong way around at the moment, isn't it?
Well, that's what we're asking for at the moment. Government's developing their chemicals policy as we speak, and we're asking them, we along with other concerned organisations, to do just that, to ask manufacturers to prove that the chemical they're using is safe before it is used. And where it's a known or suspected EDC, that we actually take that approach, that precautionary approach, and say, no, we're going to restrict that until it's proven safe. You know, and that has to be the approach. And we're concerned that the approach might be the other way around, that there's not enough evidence to say it's unsafe, so therefore we'll use it and until it's proven unsafe.
Yeah. So that is, of course, a massive turnaround which would be resisted wholesale by industry. What are the chances that anybody's ever going to do that? I mean, government is well known to be in the pocket of industry, which kind of bullies it into not being too obstructive to business. So what are the chances of making that kind of turnaround?
Well, there are some signs that industry don't want to diverge too much from the existing arrangements we had as part of the EU regime. And a lot of that did revolve around the burden of proof. And because, I suppose, changing from that that whole arrangement is very costly for industry. So that's one kind of positive thing, and that's that industry might want to kind of stick with some of the business as usual. But I agree with you that we do have a bit of a hill to climb when we're developing future policy around chemicals here. We do have an open dialogue with departments such as DEFRA, and they are inviting us to consult. They are listening to us. We're talking to the devolved administrations as well about these issues, and they are listening. So we are going in good faith. We have a lot of evidence. We around, you know, obviously the breast cancer risks, but then we work with other organisations who themselves provide a huge body of evidence and expertise as well. So, you know, we're hopeful in that respect, that we are being listened to and we are invited to consult on these issues, and it's a work in progress. So we can hope, but equally it's really important for us to work with our supporters and for our supporters to show that they care about this just as much as well. So writing to your MP and being clear about, not wanting to see these chemicals in our environment without being sure that they're safe, that also helps our cause.
Absolutely. Anyway, you're doing some great work there. One of the sort of educational points which I feel is important from the point of view of gaining supporters for what you're trying to do is that an awful lot of these chemicals have been sold to people under the banner of convenience. And people always like convenience. I mean, of course they do. If it's something that's much easier than something else, they'll think, oh yeah, I'll just buy that one. And if they're not aware of the price that they're paying for that convenience, well, why wouldn't they? So is this something you work with, education about that kind of thing?
Yeah, well, we certainly do our best to, and I mentioned to you earlier on our prevention hub, and the idea around the prevention hub is just that, to kind of unpick what appears to be really complex and difficult to understand and make it simpler for people to understand, particularly around alternatives to products that contain EDCs. But, you know, there's a lot of these so-called convenience products that are not worth, you know, they're not worth the labels they're printed on, because if you look at antimicrobial agents, for example, they're unnecessary. They're unnecessary on all products. You know, the risk that we have in not using antimicrobial is non-existent. So even during COVID, we saw the sale go up of loads of hand washes that contain triclosan, which is antimicrobial, and that was useless against the virus. So right. We don't even need these products. So a lot of the time what we say is actually you don't need to use that. So either reduce your use of that or have a look at the product labels. And there are a range of apps out there people can use. They're the kind where you scan the product and they give you a rating and they'll tell you if there's EDCs in there or any other toxins to look out for. And that's a really good way to start with. And, of course, our Prevention Hub and our iGuide, if people are really interested in seeing how important it is for us to avoid these chemicals, they can find that information in a really interesting way on our website. But a lot of the time we simply don't need these products. We don't need air fresheners. You know, open your windows, that's the best air freshener. And if you really do want scented products, then there are alternatives that don't contain EDCs.
Wow.
or products of concern.
Yeah, that's some of the good news is, of course, there are manufacturers who are aware of these issues and are doing their damnedest to make some good products that actually don't contain these chemicals. So that we have some choice these days. But you have to be quite well educated to know what you're choosing and everything. But are you able to mention the name of an app or two which will help people to discern what's what?
I can. I mean, what I'll say beforehand is that we don't endorse any of these and we don't work with these, but we recognise that they can be useful. And there are a couple. One is called Yuka, Y-U-K-A, and it's an app you download. And what we haven't done, and that's why we don't endorse them, is we haven't looked to see what their full chemical list involves and whether they categorise all of the chemicals. But from what we've seen, generally speaking, they do appear to cover a lot of those. And they also look at nutritional aspects. There are other ones, but I can't think of them. But I can certainly share them with you separately.
Yeah,
but there's about five or six out there.
Okay, well, I mean, they've got to be
easily found.
Even if they're not perfect, if you don't know very much at all, they must help you to discern a healthier product from one that isn't so healthy. So,
we've
got to use what we can. Okay, so your charity is unusual in making a strong case for organic food and the avoidance of chemicals used in farming. There's all too many other cancer charities kind of sit on the fence when it comes to the difference between organic food and other foods. So we're at Yes to Life, we're completely behind organic foods. We think they're a very important element of anybody's healthy lifestyle. But again, how much do you think this particular aspect plays into the breast cancer statistics?
Yeah, well, I think it's the same as, I suppose, what I talked about around EDCs in general. It's where, when we talk about pesticides, we don't have a huge body of evidence that pesticides contribute to breast cancer. So that's a fact. And what we do know is that previously used pesticides that are now banned, they still remain in the environment to some extent. There's not much we can do about that, and we do know that they contribute to all sorts of health issues, including hormonal cancers. Some of the currently used ones, one very commonly used one is glyphosate, and that is a known EDC. And we don't have, again, lots of evidence in terms of its link to breast cancer, but we've got enough to suspect that it has got links. And I think also in laboratories, it certainly had contributed to tumours growing in mammary glands of rats, for example. So how does it contribute generally? I think it's all part and parcel with all of the risk factors that we talk about and all of those risk factors that might increase circulating hormones in our bloodstream, so estrogen. So the more estrogenic factors we encounter, the more it increases the estrogen in our bloodstream and the more that increases our risk of breast cancer. Mm. So when we talk about eating organic, so on the one hand, it is about minimising our exposure to pesticides, much of which we still don't really know, how high the risk is. But then it's also about eating well and having a balanced diet and food as well that is food that's seasonal and food that, is full of colours, so colourful fruits and vegetables, as well as food that's high in fibre. So it's a combination of avoiding those residues as much as possible and then also having a balanced diet.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. It is this combination. One of the things about the kind of win-win, if you like, of eating better food is that not only do you get less toxins, but also you get better nutrients to deal with toxins because you can't avoid them all. But if you're nutritionally depleted, you're in a very poor position to do anything about it. Yeah. So, in the same vein, you speak out against processed food and even the mainstream media is talking quite a lot about processed food these days. Do you want to explain exactly what you mean by processed food and why you think as a food group they're something to avoid?
Yeah, there's a few reasons that we recommend avoiding processed food. First thing is around processed meats, because there is some evidence that processed meats such as bacon and other cured meats, for example, they can slightly increase our risk of breast cancer. So the evidence is there. The other thing around processed foods relates back to what I said earlier on about food contact materials. So the kind of packaging that might be used on these foods, so whether the kind of lining in a can or the plastic used on, I don't know, a piece of ham or something, there is a risk those food contact materials contain things like BPA and other chemicals, and they can potentially leak into the food. But then there's also preservatives in some of those processed foods as well, and those preservatives might increase risk. And then finally, processed foods tend to be higher in things such as fat and sugar, and they can contribute to weight increase, which is another risk factor. So there's quite a lot of reasons right. why we would suggest that people avoid processed foods, but in particular processed meats. They do have a bit of a link, an established link, albeit, you know, a smallish, moderate link. There still is a link to increased breast cancer risk.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Well, this is another of the areas where education is king, learning about. There's so much to learn about, basically.
There is.
So something you alluded to a little bit earlier on is to do with education. And, lifestyle education for cancer prevention is the one strategy which spans right across all kind of life circumstances. It's always the right answer, whether that's prevention or if you've got diagnosed with cancer, or if you're trying to prevent it coming back again. So seeing as how so much damage, it seems, can be done when someone is growing, when they're a child, the kind of nutrients and all the rest that happen in early life seem to really affect the whole trajectory of health. There's no such thing really as too soon to learn this stuff. You've already said that. But how do you aim to educate the very young?
Yeah, it's a good question, and it's something we've been thinking about for quite a long time. I mean, if we look at breast cancer risk, it is a disease of aging. The two major risk factors for breast cancer are being female and aging. And those are the risk factors we can't change. However, and also the risk in younger women is very low. Despite some of the stuff we've seen in the news, the rates in women under 40, for example, only 4% of cases are in women under 40. And if we go, even younger, when we're around 20 years old, our risk of developing cancer is extremely low. However, it is the right time to start to think about a whole lifetime worth of good habits. And so what we've been doing is through our prevention hub, for example, the fact that we've made it bespoke, we have enabled it to be, talking to different people according to their lifestyle and what's important to them in their life, and also, what they're capable of changing or the things that they're motivated by. So a lot of our content, a lot of the research we've been doing has been very much around how can we engage younger people with the material that's relevant to them. And so our website has changed quite a lot in the past couple of years, and we've had a lot of input from young people, and we get a lot more input now from young people. And we do a lot of talks. We go to schools as well. And we're developing a whole part of our hub is that we will be developing in the next 6 months also a whole new section targeting actually much younger people, so sixth form age, let's say, where we will be talking directly with them about their concerns, but also things that they can do now and for the rest of their lives to really make the most of reducing their risk of ever developing the disease.
Mm. Oh, well, I think that sounds like a great age to be talking to people, because, of course, younger than that, you'd need to be talking to their parents, wouldn't you? Because they'd be the biggest
yes.
influence on their lifestyle. But, at that kind of school-leaving age, the beginnings of independence are just beginning to appear, and somebody can think about what they want for their life going forward. So, yeah, good time. So not much time left, but a quick mention for the men. Breast cancer is generally seen as exclusively a women's disease, but actually this isn't the case, is it? How common is it amongst men, and do all the same risk factors apply to men?
Well, it's a lot less common in men. So about 1% of cases happen in men. And so that translates to about 370 men a year receive a diagnosis. So compared to 55,000 for women, 56,000 for women, that's not nowhere near as high, but it's not insignificant either. In terms of the risk factors, and a lot of men, because we're actually developing another thing we're doing is we're developing a breast cancer in men whole section on our hub as well, and that should be ready by the end of this year. And incidentally, we are inviting your listeners to go to our website, breastcanceruk.org.uk/men, and help us to understand what's important to men and how we can best support them and the services that we provide. So just by completing a little survey. But in terms of risk factors for men, they're very similar to women and the action they can take is very similar. So things like physical activity really counts for men as well. There are some slight nuances in men, and one of them is that men who develop breast cancer are more likely to have had a family history, and particularly a single gene mutation, such as the BRCA gene, which is much less prevalent for women. So women might have the BRCA gene mutation, but that makes up about 2 to 3% of breast cancer diagnosis in women. But in men, it can make up to about 20%. So that seems to be a bigger factor in determining whether or not men develop breast cancer. But in terms of reducing risk, even with a family history and a single gene mutation, there is still action we can take to reduce our risk of developing the disease. And I think that's a really important message.
Right. And, of course, well, if that one particular factor looms so much larger for a man, that's massively more, isn't it, than for women. It's obviously something to pay a lot of attention to, and the things that can ameliorate the effects of that gene. The lifestyle changes that could actually prevent you from damage that comes from that source.
Yeah, I mean, if you have that BRCA gene mutation, then you are at a much higher risk of developing breast cancer. But those preventative actions still can contribute to reducing your risk, and that's the key message.
Right, which is true for women as well. But yeah. All right, interesting. Okay, so last thing, I just wanted to ask, much of the prevention advice that you give, which is all directed at breast cancer, could equally well be applied to prevention of lots of other cancers or chronic diseases. Things like air pollution is bad for everybody. It's probably true for kind of related cancers, like hormone-driven cancers other than breast cancer, even more. So, do you restrict yourself entirely to breast cancer and you resist straying into related territory like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. And you're right. I think the work that we do around breast cancer prevention, there are similarities to other cancer preventions in terms of the advice we give and other diseases, actually, that are not cancer. But the research we do and the advice we give around reducing our risk is a little bit nuanced when it comes to breast cancer. So things like a woman's weight after menopause is really directly related to her risk of breast cancer. But it can have an impact, obviously. Keeping a healthy weight can have an impact on reducing other risks. A few years ago, as an organisation, we did start thinking about it. We had a bit of a conversation at our board level around, is this something that we should be thinking about? Should we be thinking more broadly about cancer prevention, or should we be thinking more about moving into environmental chemicals as prevention? What we concluded was that there's a lot of work to be done with breast cancer, given that it's the most common cancer in the world, in the UK and the world. And there's still so much to be done to really understand that disease from a preventative point of view. And also we don't have the resources right now to expand our remit to the point where we would have any impact if we broadened it. Right. We do work with other organisations that have similar concerns, so the Cancer Prevention and Education Society. They share a lot of our concerns, particularly around chemicals, but their focus is on other chemicals of concern, in particular, say, fire retardants, mm-hmm. or flame retardants. They are very common chemicals used in furnishings and furniture in the UK, and we're concerned about them too. And that tends to be that area of focus, whereas we focus on other EDCs more. Again, all of these EDCs matter, but we tend to look at where there's the strongest evidence. And so bisphenols, for example, that I mentioned earlier on, is an area of focus for us at the moment in our science, but also in the work we do when we talk to public health bodies and the government. But there's so much work to be done, and if we only we could achieve everything.
Well, this is it. There is so much to be done. We're in some ways we're in such a corner with cancer. You know, there's just so many factors driving it along. We know so little really about what the direct causes are. We just got lots of ideas about it, which are not substantiated enough to get anybody to change anything. And yeah, you're working with one cancer, and how many are there? At least a couple of hundred. It's a shocking situation, really. And of course, given unlimited resources, we really do need a charity that's doing this work right across the board on behalf of everybody. Of course, it's absolutely marvellous what you're doing, and you seem to be doing an amazing amount in you know the field you're in. But it sounds like we could do with another 10, by the circumstance. Anyway, very interesting to talk to you today. Thanks so much, Dali, for explaining some of this. And I've learned a bit today, and I hope our listeners have found out something as well. So thank you very much.
It's an absolute pleasure. Can I just remind your listeners to go to our website, sure. breastcanceruk.org.uk. There you'll find our hub, which I've mentioned several times. But it's also Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we have lots of activities that you can get involved in free online to get physically active and build physical activity into your everyday life. So please go there, sign up. We've got a fitness festival at the end of this month. 30th and 31st of October. That's free to sign up. There's lots happening and prizes as well. So what better reason than to get involved and also start to reduce your risk of breast cancer?
Great. Thank you very much, Tali.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Fascinating to talk to Tali about this hugely important topic. But also utterly scary to contemplate the scale of the environmental problems we're facing as a result of the last century of consumerism. Thanks for listening today. I wish you a great week, and if you're up against health challenges yourself, I wish you good progress on a path to wellness. Please join me again next week for another Yes to Life show here on UK Health Radio. Goodbye.